Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Back about 10 years ago, in the mid-2010s, NASS decided that we were not going to continue with year-round reporting on some of these state offices. And that makes sense because for the vast majority of the country, it is an off-season once you get into the late autumn and winter months.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey on State Story reports.
This gives us an opportunity, though, to catch up once a month on some of our crop conditions for overwintering crops, such as winter wheat. Also, a look for some states at rangeland and pasture conditions. And also a little glance at how some of the soil moisture levels are going as we head through the winter months. So it's not a full comprehensive national report, but it certainly does give a little glimpse as to what is going on out there in farm country during the off-season.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So whether we pursue a single reconciliation bill or multiple bills, we can't lose sight of the goal, and that's to pass President Trump's agenda for the American people.
On the floor of the Senate Wednesday, Texas Senator John Cornyn on a reconciliation bill and finding savings.
That's what the November 5th election was all about. And we are in lockstep with President Trump, I believe, the majority in the House and the Senate, to accomplish that goal. But we can't do it unless we work closely together, which is why we need to be on the same page. We need to quickly arrive at that agreement so we can act swiftly to implement the solutions that will help improve the day-to-day lives of our constituents, the people we represent. In my case, 31 million people in the state of Texas. President Biden's policies have been a disaster for my state and for the American people. Texans have been suffering under open borders and high prices for the last 4 years. Those who run businesses are facing burdensome regulations from the out-of-control regulatory regime. And on top of this, as I mentioned, if Republicans fail to act swiftly to extend the expiring tax cuts, 62% of taxpayers will experience a tax increase. 62%. We can't let that happen. It would be insult to injury on top of 40-year high inflation for the American people to have to experience a tax cut if we are tax increase if we are unsuccessful. So while we have important conversations and some healthy debates over what budget reconciliation ends up looking like, we need to keep our eye on the prize in order to deliver on these critical priorities for the American people. Now, in addition to border security, abundant American energy, regulatory reform, permitting reform, and avoiding this multi-trillion-dollar tax increase, there's one more thing that I'd like my colleagues to remember as we deliberate the contents of this package. I believe we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to deal with some of the biggest challenges that faces America, and we can't squander that opportunity. We have to address not only our discretionary spending, which is about 28% of what the federal government spends each year, but also our mandatory spending programs outside of Social Security and Medicare. We're not going to touch Social Security or Medicare absent some bipartisan agreement. But there is still about $700 billion of mandatory spending that the federal government spends each year that is essentially on autopilot. We can address these mandatory spending programs by implementing common sense reforms to programs like SNAP, otherwise known as food stamps, that have grown unchecked for years. By simply reducing payment errors for SNAP payments, for example, we could save an estimated $100 billion. By implementing a real work requirement for means-tested programs like Congress did back during the Clinton presidency, we could save an incredible amount of money for the American people and help ease inflation so that the Federal Reserve can bring down interest rates. Or we could repeal the controversial 2021 Thrifty Food Plan that would save as much as $300 billion. You know, we're talking about real money, Mr. President.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The cash cattle markets on Friday, just AMS called the five area market at 197. I will note that's ending the year quite nicely.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonser on cash markets.
Flipping over feeder cattle, there was little to no reported activity by USDA this past week, and that's the holiday effect. Lots of auction barns were closed. But again, I will note particularly the fourth quarter of 2024 that's now complete ended with a very strong tone to it in the feeder cattle market. I think that reflected tightening supplies. Past guests, I'm sure, have talked about the, you know, the situation in the Mexican border makes that even tighter. Who knows how long that's going to last here into 2025. But, you know, to put a bow on the cash market, fed cattle was up, not much action in the feeder cattle market. And I expect this coming week to be kind of slow as well because of weather. So before I break down the rest, I'll just kind of remind folks. My family resides, and I'm talking to you from St. George, Kansas, which is just a little bit east of Manhattan. The National Weather Service claims we got 18 inches of snow on Sunday here. This farm boy moved it yesterday, and I thought it was 15 inches. So hopefully my house is a little bit better. But the Kansas City Airport reported 11 inches of snow just on Sunday. And what I read there was that's the fourth largest single day snowfall. So I'm belaboring this because the I-70 corridor took a hit on snow. The moisture part of that's good, but ice underneath it wasn't. And the cold the next couple of days is worth watching. I suspect that's going to have some implications on, you know, logistics. Grain coming in out of feed yards, cattle going to packing plants and so forth will be disrupted. But I want to add that on as, you know, I said we have this pause in the cash market because of holidays. I think weather is going to add to that pause is the point.
Says when it comes to demand, we're actually seeing a very impressive story.
I think the tighter supply of cattle hooves and yet the ability of the market to absorb more beef than we expected. And this is where animals and beef aren't the same is really important to appreciate is in 2024, we put more pounds on every animal leaving the feed yard than most analysts expected. That was the story, you know, Q2 through the end of the year, really. And the ability of the market to absorb that without depressing prices to me is a strong testament to demand was, you know, stable, if not strong, depending on what month we talk about it, what cut. That is great news going into 2025. I recently wrote a piece for the In Cattle Market series that LMIC, you know, tees up. And I try to get some context around the importance of demand, how it fits into that 2025 picture.
Should we celebrate higher prices?
The next major report will be the January cattle inventory report. So at the very end of January, we're expecting USDA NAS to put out estimates to tell us, you know, the total national beef cow herd size, some of that by state, heifer retention insights, so forth. What I noted in that piece was, I think it's going to say we started 2025 with even fewer mama cows than we did 2024. So not only have we not started expansion, I think we liquidated a little bit more, maybe 1% fewer cows to start the year, which to me tells me, you know, by definition, if that's true, we haven't started expansion and it'll be the summer of 2026 in my mind before that gets started in any real like nationally relevant context. And then I transition in here to this term demand destruction. I hear the term off and on, and I think we're going to hear it more the next, you know, 24, maybe even 48 months. And it gets confused is the reason I bring it up. Is people use that term because they think just because beef prices are going up, we're destroying demand. Economists like me get a little bit upset when we do that because we're confounding the terms of, you know, per capita consumption, consumption per person and demand when we do that. The role of price is to allocate scarce resources. And as we've shrunk the herd, we're in the process of probably producing less beef the next couple of years. And the industry should actually be cheering for higher retail beef prices because if we don't accomplish that when there's less beef on the market, then I'm going to have to tell the world that beef demand fell. So when you have lower supply, we, you know, if demand is stable, if not growing, we expect prices to go up. That's what we should be cheering for. And I was trying to give some words of caution around the term of demand destruction a little bit proactively, because I think that theme is going to be pretty strong as we go through 2025.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I've been to the Lincoln National Forest and observed something very, very amazing there.
The only forester in Congress is Representative Bruce Westerman, returning as chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee.
Same landscape, same climate, same forest and tree species. You've got the Muscalera Apache tribe that is textbook forest management. Beautiful forest out there. Ponderosa pine. It's got your savanna understory in it. Great elk hunting. Just beautiful habitat. You go up the road a few miles, and you're in the Lincoln National Forest, which it had one of those fires. And I don't remember how many years ago, but it's like a moonscape. The fire burned so hot that it burned the organic matter out of the soil, and they can't get trees to grow back on it. Everything the same, except you had the Forest Service managing one tract of land, you had the Muscular Apache managing another tract. And that's why we just passed out a committee this morning a bill to do good neighbor authority, which says tribes and counties, in addition to state forest management agencies, can go in and manage timber on federal lands. They know how to do it. They're able to do it. So let's give them the authority to go in and make these good management decisions. But you can, that story I told about New Mexico, it's been replicated other times in New Mexico. You can go to California, Arizona, go to Washington State. You'll see over and over where you've got severe damage to the soil because of mismanagement of forest. And people don't always make that link between water and forestry. Now, Teddy Roosevelt called trees the lungs of the earth. They breathe in carbon dioxide. They breathe out oxygen, which they are. There's nothing we can use to clean the air, to get carbon out of the atmosphere as efficient and as effectively and as large scale and economically as a forest. Forests also are as critical to water as they are to air. You talked about these as, I'll use Roosevelt's terms, a denuded landscape. You take this barren landscape, you get rain on it, you get mudslides, your topsoil, what's left of it ends up in the streams, which decreases water quality, damages fish habitat. You know, when you do good forest management, if there's a stream, you leave something called the streamside management zone. A wildfire doesn't leave streamside management zones. It burns right to the edge of the stream. That shade over a stream helps keep water cool for certain fish species. You take that shade away, the water temperature increases. There's just so many wins to having healthy managed forest. You win with air quality, you win with water quality, you win with wildlife habitat, you win with recreation opportunities, and the list goes on. There's no downside to having a healthy forest. We just have to help our forest be healthy instead of getting in the way and making them unhealthy.
And there's actually a product from the forest that could save the forest, biochar.
Biochar is almost pure carbon. We could take this understory in the western forest that's fueling the catastrophic wildfires, make a usable product out of it, put it on agriculture and rangeland, and even back on forest land, and it makes your soil more productive, holds more water, retains more nutrients, makes them available for plant uptake, and also makes your forest healthy. So there's so many natural solutions to the problems we face today. We just have to have the will in Congress to push that policy forward, to let the innovators innovate, and let this great country thrive.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Technically, they would have to reintroduce the legislative package, but there is sort of a baseline or a format that's already been introduced.
Cody Besson is CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
Chairman G.T. Thompson and his staff and members really did yeoman's work of trying to set that pace and set the standard of making those enhancements that we obviously need to get to a better set of farm policy that will help producers in the long term, so we don't have to continue to look at economic assistance or disaster-related assistance. I think the other thing that will complement this is on the Senate side, you had sort of kind of a quagmire between then the chairwoman, who is now retired and has a new ranking member and a new Senate dynamics. So you have Senator Bozeman, who is now the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee, and you have ranking member Globuchar, who is out of Minnesota. And then you also have a new ranking member on the House side as well with the House Ag Committee, Angie Craig. And so I think there'll be some really unique demographics that get to really parlay together, really work together and come together more so than some of the dynamics that we saw going into the end of the 118th and the new 119th Congress that is just now getting started. There's a lot of appetite, I would say, to really come together, work together to enhance the policy that we have on the books today and really kind of walk the line and make sure that the policy that is being developed is substantial, that will help over the next 4 to 5 years in the length term of a farm bill process. That way we can have more focus on other issues as well and not having to come back and ask for ad hoc assistance. So there's a lot of other issues they need to focus on too, like trade and tax reform and other large scale issues. And so there's a little bit more of a jihad between the House and Senate four corners than there once was at this point in time.
That's the farm bill, but ag needs trade.
So ag is in a pretty unique position that we're very reliant upon trade because we export a vast majority of our program crops. So in cotton, by example, it's anywhere from 85 to 90% of our raw fiber is exported overseas. Wheat, by another example, is usually about 50 to 60%, and other commodities are just as much the same. And it's been very prevalent within the president-elect that he wants to tackle trade, make sure that trade is being more implemented in a fair and equitable manner. And even more so, just trying to enforce enforcement measures that have been put in place for current law that's on the books. And that's one of the other key things that I think people need to continue to focus on, is that there needs to be some teeth into what's being developed and negotiated and what has been negotiated in the past. Now, will that come with some challenges? There's probably no doubt in that. And we're certainly being very mindful of that, because there could have some fluctuations and gyrations in marketing implications for tackling that issue because of how much dependent we are on the global-based economy and how that impacts our prices that fluctuate on a day-to-day basis. And so we're very mindful of that. But at the same time, we need to continue to advocate for more stronger, robust trade policies that impact the grower level, but all the way through the consumer and infrastructure level as well, in a positive-based manner. And so there's a level playing field versus one having a larger bureaucracy than the other.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Each month we survey 400 farmers across the U.S. to learn more about their perspectives on the ag economy.
Dr. Jim Mentert is with the Purdue University CME Ag Economy Barometer.
This month's Ag Barometer survey was conducted from the 2nd through the 6th of December 2024. The Ag Economy Barometer Index declined 9 points this month to a reading of 136, but that still left the index 21 points higher than it was in October, and even more so when you compare it back to September. I think in September it was down all the way to 88. So, Michael, were you surprised that we saw a decline in the barometer this month?
It wasn't a big enough decline that it really surprised me all that much. I think the key point that you made is still much higher than it was in September and October.
Yeah, from my perspective, it's probably going to be really interesting to see what happens in January. Going back to 2016, we saw, I think, 3 months of increases in late 2016, early 2017, following the first Trump election success. And so it begs the question, are we going to see a little bit of a rebound in January? Or maybe did the small decline that we showed in December, is that going to continue into January?
Yeah, my guess is be relatively flat. That's always the safest guess, right?
The no change forecast. Yeah. Okay. When you look at the current condition index and the future expectation index, you can kind of see the difference in terms of what was going on there. Current condition index fell 13 points compared to last month to a reading of 100. That's just 5 points higher than it was in October. The future expectation index declined as well, but only 8 points compared to November. And that left it 29 points higher than October. So current condition index just up 5 points compared to October. Future expectation up 29 points compared to October. So clearly people are still feeling more optimistic about the future.
And just to give some idea of how unusual this is, there's a 53-point difference between the index of future expectations, index of current conditions. That's about unheard of. I mean, we saw that back in late 2016, but this is not typical. If you do see a difference between those, it's usually closer to 10 to 20 points.
Yeah, so for listeners, if you have a chance to look at the charts that accompany this podcast, it really stands out when you see the chart, that difference that Michael was just referring to, the divergence between the two indices. And you're right, that's very unusual to see that take place. So people are really putting a heavy weight on what they think could happen down the road. The Farm Financial Performance Index dropped back 8 points compared to November. But that still left that index above where it was in October. So it's at a reading of 98 versus 106 last month. But in October, it was 90. And going back to September, that Farm Financial Performance Index was all the way down to 68. So again, people are still feeling better about things than they were before the election, certainly in early fall, late summer time frame.
And you put that in perspective, the 98 is higher than it was in early 24. If you remember back to early 24, we had stronger prices, particularly corn, compared to what we had at the end of the year. And so it's a little surprising.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. If you go back 12 months, the index was sitting at 97. So we're 1 point higher than 12 months ago. And yet we know from looking, for example, the budgets that you maintain here at Purdue, Michael, farm incomes in 2024 are going to be, particularly for corn and soybean operations, going to be significantly lower.
Yeah, they're going to be quite low.
Farm Capital Investment Index was down 7 points compared to a month ago, but it was still 5 points higher than a year ago. That index is now sitting at 48.
Jim Mentert and Michael Langemeyer with the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are a number of phenomena that are impacting agricultural land ownership and investment in this country. I want to highlight a couple of them.
David Haight is Vice President of Programs at the American Farmland Trust on why ownership and investment in U.S. farmland matters.
First is changes that are happening in the farming and ranching community. Particularly change in intergenerational transfers of farm and ranches. According to the 2017 Census of Agriculture, there were four times more senior farmers in this country than young farmers, and 40% of those senior operators did not identify a young farmer being involved in the ownership and or management of their farm. This is significant because farms that are at a time of transfer are vulnerable for many of these families. They're going to have to look outside the family for that next generation. Certainly, for some, this is a time when they can be lost to real estate development. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of acres. Senior farmers and landowners in this country own 370 million acres of agricultural land. So you could imagine in the next 20 years, there will literally be hundreds of millions of acres changing hands. At the same time, research from the United States Department of Agriculture, the American Farmland Trust, Farm Bureau, many others have identified barriers for beginning farmers and ranchers. One of the biggest being accessing land. It's hard to identify land that's available and is suited for the type of enterprise you might want to launch, being able to afford the price of land because of competition, or if leased land is available, being able to have lease terms that offer the type of security that a beginning farmer or rancher might need to be successful. So this transfer of farms from one generation to the next will literally reshape how hundreds and millions of acres are owned in this country. There's also a significant amount of land in this country that is owned by non-farmers and rented to farmers. The map that you see here is from the 2017 Census of Agriculture. It identifies the amount of rented land by county across the country. Overall, roughly 40% of the agricultural land in America is owned by non-farmers. This includes individuals like former farmers, family members of farmers, people that just bought land as individuals for different reasons, as well as institutional buyers. Certainly, it's not just the non-farmers that want to own land for and then rent it for agricultural purposes. There's also other non-farm buyers, people that want to own agricultural land and convert it to other uses. The American Farmland Trust released a report last year called Farms Under Threat 2040. It projects that roughly 18 million acres of agricultural land across this country is going to be fragmented, developed, paved over by 2040. This is not going to be spread equally around the country. It's particularly concentrated in states like Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, other parts of the Southeast. So this competition for land with other potential buyers is going to be a significant force that is going to be shaping land ownership patterns in the future.
He was a participant in a Farm Foundation forum on foreign ownership of farmland. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Almost a year ago at the USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum, the department's chief economist noted this problem. Problem as a defined value term.
It's going to be a problem, and it certainly has proven to be an issue of growing volumes of used cooking oil imports.
And chief economist Seth Myers says used cooking oil was one of the few surging imports of farm and food products in 2024. It was also unexpected by several, as our nation grows its own biofuels industry. Yet he explains,
this is being driven by biofuel policy. These are the kinds of things which, when I look forward, are elements not directly in the marketplace. It's these types of policies, farm bill policies, environmental policies, biofuel policies. I think these are things that, as we look forward in the next year, might have notable impact because the market has certainly come down from the basic fundamentals imposing a lot of volatility on prices.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.